everyone who loves books. This is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your weekly compendium of the best in books and reading. I'm your host Red Sale, and as it's the Easter holidays, we've got a little basket of treats for you to listen to.
I'm Robert Kirkwood, and as Red said, we'll have a look back over some of our favourite interviews, including one that was live on stage at the Edinburgh Festival, and one from the Booker Prize in 2012.
And I'll be talking to the UK's only blind narrator and exploring the examined life with psychotherapist Stephen Gross.
That's all coming up in today's Read On.
First up, here's Kate Akello telling us her very personal reasons for being an RNIB narrator.
I'm delighted to be joined today in the studio by Kate Akello. Would you like to tell us how you became a talking books narrator?
So it's quite a personal thing for me, but I grew up with a blind mother and a blind uncle. Very, very capable people, very proud of them, but they were also avid readers when they could see. And so obviously when they lost their sight, it was very important to them that they still had the books that they enjoy reading. I was brought up always hearing talking books. When mum's ironing, when mum's in the bath, when mum's working out, she always has a talking book on. And to be honest, she can stay up until about 4 a.m. listening to them. They're addictive. And I realised as I got older how much an important thing it is for her to have that available to her, that really it would be silly if I didn't approach that as a skill that maybe I could help out with. The first time that my mum heard the audiobook, she found it online at 2 a.m. and I went into her bedroom and saw a very bleary-eyed, tired mother who decided that because it was my first audiobook, she had to stay up the entire night listening to it. And actually it was just such an emotional moment, really, because for some people it's, you know, it's just an audio book, but for me it's the only time that my mum gets to really see everything that I do as its whole. Obviously on stage there's always some visuals missing, but an audio book, it's just you, it's just the voice, and it's just the story. And so my mum experiencing that and being able to give that gift to her, and my uncle as well, was really, really special, and I'm so glad that I knocked on those doors and sent those emails.
One of the things I love about having professional actors reading the talking books is you are our eyes, and you're the person who puts the nuance into the voices and brings them alive and off the page.
When you do read a book, I must develop about 70 different accents in my head, and you always have voices for different characters. I remember in my audition for Here, I decided that I'd show them all the accents that I could do, so I chose a court scene of a book called Vernon Godlittle, where everybody was being questioned. And basically, I think we had an African in there, we had someone from Scotland, but actually, the more variation you can get, the more realistic it is to how you'd imagine it.
Do you have a favourite accent?
Well, I was born and bred in Newcastle, so I do kind of enjoy going back into the northeast accent when I can. I think it's always important that as an actor and a reader that you remember your roots and that you appreciate them and you nurture them as often as possible.
And what are you reading at the moment?
Amy Wilde, and it's by Helen Skelton, who actually, if people watched Blue Peter maybe a couple of years ago, she did a lot of the comic relief and the sports relief things. She did Thousands of Miles in the Amazon Forest, so this is actually set in the Amazon. A young girl from the northeast goes with her aunt Marge, and we're about to find out all the adventures and the mischief that she gets up to. She's quite a naughty kid, which I...
Can you relate to that?
I can relate to that a little bit, but...
From a novice to an old hand...
I am very much an old hand.
I'm delighted to be joined by a voice that is not only familiar to me, but I hope to many of our listeners, Penelope Freeman.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
So tell me, what have you been reading?
I have just actually finished The Inheritance by Jenny Pitman. It's a tale of doping and double dealing and sabotage and all kinds of other things, but yeah, it's been good fun.
I can't wait. That'll be one to brighten up the winter's evenings. So how did you start as a narrator for talking books?
Very, very simply, actually. I had a partially sighted grandmother. We were always trying to get her to listen to talking books, so I applied to the talking book studios. I wrote and I wrote and I bombarded and didn't get seen. And then finally I did, and sadly that coincided with my father becoming partially sighted. And my mum, who was an avid reader, got addicted to them too, so they would sit side by side and listen to talking books. It's just been historically in my family, And I like as many times as I can to come into the studios and do it. I do it professionally elsewhere.
And do you have a favourite genre that you like to read, or will you tackle anything?
I tend to get stories that are quite women-centric. I would secretly like to do more kids' books.
It reminds us of that, those wonderful days when your mum would read to you before you went to bed. Mm. And a good and sympathetic reading is one of the most comforting things I think you can have.
It's lovely for all kinds of reasons, because it does unscramble your brain. You just put your, you know, there's nothing worse than going to bed, putting your head on the pillow and thinking, oh, what have I got to do tomorrow? And, oh, I didn't kind of do that today or whatever. And you end up not going to sleep. I'm sure it's sleepless nights. People have them all the time because they are constantly having busy brains now. And it's a wonderful way of giving your brain a massage. That's the best way I can describe it.
So have there ever been books where you've read the first few chapters and just gone, I actually can't do this, and you've had to hand them back to the Talking Books Library and say, give me something else?
As a narrator, no. There was one I was very close to again, and I realised I was finding it quite disturbing. And it was only when I got a little bit further on in the preparation that I realised somebody had also been prepping the book, and they clearly had got to a point in the book where the prep, the pencil marks on the page had gone, and I realised that that was the point that they had probably given the book back. I thought, well, if RNIB had had difficulty already getting a narrator, and this clearly was one that was on the list to be recorded, I had to overcome that.
You were talking about the pencil marks in the margin. Mm. I've always wondered how the narrators keep the continuity. Do you keep notes at the front of the book?
Every reader does it differently, and every reader uses a different format. I read a book twice before I record it. The first is just to get a gist of the story, to get an idea of the pace of it and the genre and everything. And then the second, where I sit down and every single character I write out. And then the other thing I always do, the day of a recording, I go through the entire cast of characters. I try and remember as many as I can and put a voice to each one of them.
I always think that the narrators are discovering the plot at the same pace as I am, so not to bring in any vocal spoilers is quite an art, I should imagine.
Strangely enough, in a way, it's not. You have to be in the moment. You have to make it now. When it gets exciting, your voice changes and you're going, oh, this is about to happen and that's about to happen. And you modulate accordingly, but you have to be in the moment to do it. Hopefully, it stays fresh that way.
Thanks again to Kate Akello and Penelope Freeman. And we'll be talking to more narrators later in the show. But first, here's an interview that Robert really wasn't looking forward to.
Yes, this one was from a while ago. The Booker Prize in 2012. We always interview the shortlisted authors on Read On, or as it was at the time, Talking Books. In 2012, author Will Self was on the shortlist with his Stream of Consciousness novel, Umbrella.
Well, it's a really, it's a novel about a woman called Audrey Death, rather freighted name that, and she's born in the 1890s in Fulham in London, working class family. She has a couple of brothers called Stanley and Albert. Stanley's younger and grows up to be a bit of a dreamer, and like Audrey herself, falls in with kind of Ruskinian Fabian socialists. Audrey becomes a suffragette, joins the Women's Political and Social Union, and at the outbreak of the First War, in a large part because Stanley enlists, as many slightly lost and perhaps idealistic young men did at that time, in the army, Audrey becomes what was known as a munitionette and works in the Woolwich Arsenal during the First War, where her elder brother, Albert, somewhat coincidentally, has become head of the arsenal, responsible for munitions production. In the closing months of the war, Audrey falls victim to a disease known as encephalitis lethargica, an epidemic of which swept Europe at this time, sort of bizarre precursor to the more famous Spanish flu epidemic. And what happened to the encephalitis lethargica victims was a third of them died, more or less, a third of them recovered completely, and a third of them seemed to recover, and then a year, 2 years, maybe longer, they fell in, either they became subject to this dreadful condition known as sleep apnea, where they couldn't sleep at all and then died, or else they fell into these strange kind of coma states, where they stayed for decades, many of them ending up in long-term mental institutions. And that formed the backdrop to Oliver Sacks' very famous kind of neurological case history of these patients called Awakenings, which was also made into a major motion picture starring Robin Williams and Robert De Niro. And Sacks, you know, awoke some, noticing the similarity between encephalitis lethargica and Parkinson's disease, which at that time was being treated with a new drug called L-DOPA. Sacks awoke a cohort of encephalitis lethargica patients at a hospital in Brooklyn in the States. He wrote about that. And rather like that scenario in my novel Umbrella, Audrey is one of a group of patients who are awoken in 1971 by a psychiatrist called Dr. Zach Busner at Free and Barnet Mental Hospital in North London. So that's the basic scenario of the novel.
Now, Umbrella is written in a style that doesn't really lend itself to the audio format. Do you have some sympathy for the narrator and the engineer?
Well, I've always got sympathy for narrators and engineers. The company that's doing the talking book asked me to read it. I've done a couple of maybe two or three of my books as talking books myself. And in a way, I think I probably should have taken it on, because I do understand. One of the problems is that in the written text, I use italics in a quite specific but quite modulated way to indicate what I call intensified thought. You know, so that point at which thought actually becomes words in the mind. And that's quite difficult to articulate when one's reading aloud, but it can be done. But I think it needs somebody who knows the text very well and is prepared to take their time over it. So I certainly will be speaking, I hope, at length to the actor who'll be reading it, because I had to turn down the job myself. I just don't have the time at the moment to do it.
Now, when you write in the stream of consciousness, is it hard to come back to it after, say, you're coming back to it the next day? Is it a difficult return?
No, I didn't find it so. I mean, my decisions for writing both a form of stream of consciousness, because, of course, in absolute terms, it's almost impossible to set down the content of anybody's mind on paper. I mean, it makes no sense. We tend to think kind of imagistically, I think, you know, whether we think in smells, we think in touches, we think, you know, those of us who are sighted think in visual images, and, you know, so it seems to me that there's very little of our thought that actually consists in language. So my kind of stream of consciousness is obviously a kind of, you know, only a crude approximation of that. But my decision to use that and my decision to write in the continuous present rather than the simple past, which most narrative prose is, were really emotional decisions. You know, I just felt at an emotional level that this story needed to be told that way. And on that basis, returning to the emotional zone within which I was composing wasn't a difficult thing to do at all. No.
Now, the hospital is now, I think it's Princess Park Manor, and it's now a residential development home to boy band members and other celebrities. Does that surprise you?
Well, I think it was Ian Sinclair who noted in his book London Orbital that these great asylums around the kind of periphery of London, like Shenfield and Free and Barnet, Tooting Beck, you know, had been turned into luxury flats developments. I'm sure it's true of other cities throughout Britain as well. Does it surprise me? Well, it's easy to not be surprised with the benefit of hindsight, I suppose. It's a development that came in. It happened in the early 90s when the big long-term mental institutions were closed down under this policy of kind of returning patients to, in inverted commas, care in the community, that well-known oxymoron. And so it's been going on for 20 years or so now. I think the asylums like prisons, are kind of synecdoches of the wider society. They represent part for whole and whole for part. You know, the regimes within the asylums seem in a kind of slightly hellish way to have reflected society outside. So maybe their fate in becoming luxury flats during the great kind of property speculating boom of the 90s and noughties is a rather suitable one in a way.
Now, you mentioned you've narrated some of your own work, including the whole 18-hour-long book of Dave. Did you enjoy the process? And did you? I've had this with some writers who've read their own work. Did you resist the impulse to edit it as you were reading?
That's a very good question. Would it be very difficult with studio time hired and working with a hard-pressed and, I may say, very brilliant engineer to prevail upon him to to take some breaks while I rewrite? But, of course, I think what you've put your finger on is that it can be quite painful to reread, in, as it were, in depth. And you have to read. If you're doing a talking book, I always think, I mean, I do a lot of public readings, and I believe strongly in the oral component of literature. I think it's an important thing to do. And I think if you're, the only way to get an auditor to kind of, or assistant auditor, hopefully, to suspend disbelief in what you're doing is to believe in it yourself. You have to bring that level of conviction to what you're doing. And therefore, you have to kind of try and believe in your own text. And, of course, that exposes it to the most rigorous critical intelligence possible, which is the person who wrote it in the first place. And that's a very uncomfortable feeling, because obviously there are passages where you think, oh, give over. That's absolute nonsense. Nobody's going to buy that. You know, so that's the really uncomfortable feeling. Editing it, I'm afraid, is out of the question. You just can't do it.
Now, was it a surprise to end up on the shortlist? And at the time of recording, I've just looked it up, you are the bookie's favourite.
Yeah, it's a worrying thing that, isn't it? you always think that the judges are going to sit down and think, well, we've got to avoid giving it to the bookie's favourite. You know, it's going to be their first inclination, isn't it? Yes, it was an enormous surprise, huge surprise. I mean, I wrote the book as I wrote it, very much out of emotional conviction. I think a lot of critics have said, oh, well, it's a tribute to Ulysses, it's an homage to high modernism, it's got all sorts of clever literary jokes in it. I'm not insensible to the fact that those, you know, currents are there in the text, but really it's quite a conventional novel in many ways. It's about things, and it's about things I felt strongly about, which is really the idea that, you know, individual pathologies, the sort of illnesses that happen to us in life, in some strange way may be linked to wider social and economic developments. You know, and I felt strongly about this as a story and as a way of expressing these ideas. And when I was working on the book last year and into the winter of last year, I was looking at this stuff on the page, and I had a deep emotional conviction that I had to do it this way, but I was looking at it and thinking, this is just going to bomb. Nobody's going to read this. It's difficult. It's, you know, I'd done several things like deliberately incorporated a lot of particular cultural and historical references that people, I think, quite justifiably on first reading of it or first listening of it, won't get. You know, and there's no reason why they should get them. And I did it because I wanted to. You know, I think most period writing actually includes a lot of things that people already know about the past. You know, they make the past a kind of not a different place, but the same place as the present by writing about a past that is our past. And I wanted to create a real sense of estrangement about the past, because I think people's mental content in the early 1900s was totally different to ours and didn't include these references, which only history have made salient. So all of those things combined to make me feel that it was not a book that was likely to find a lot of readers.
Last year, the judges talked a lot about readability and were criticised for it. Not that I'm saying that it's not a readable book, but do you think they've included it because of that?
Well, I mean, I can't second guess their decisions. I mean, as against whether people find the text, you know, I mean, at one extreme, it seems to me, there are texts that purely depend on page turning, you know, and whether it's an erotic impulse or a, or in the case of partially sighted or blind people, on as it were, mental page turning in that way, and, you know, continuing listening. And, you know, what drives that on can be whodunit or, you know, who's had sex with who. I mean, to be blunt, it's fairly base instincts that will pull people through a text, even the kind of narrative hook, wanting to find out what's happened. I'd argue isn't the best impulse for absorbing yourself in literature. That being said, I think while people may find, you know, the first, you know, 70 pages if they're looking at the text, or say the first hour or two if they're listening to the book, slightly confusing. I think that once readers tell me, once they've adjusted to the register of it, they do find it curiously compelling. It seems to me one person's readability is another person's unreadability. So it seems to me a very subjective criteria.
I noticed that when I heard you reading some of it on, let's say, another radio station, that the first few sentences were a bit clunky, but as soon as you got over that, it was very listenable to. It flowed very freely.
Well, I hope so. I mean, obviously one tries to make one's prose euphonious and to incorporate all of the poetic tropes that help to make things sound good, you know, alliteration, consonants, assonants, rhythm, you know, that all of these things are important, it seems to me, to prose. And you know, one wants, in a sense, to, if there's a particularly telling or beautiful phrase in a text that one's exposed to, one wants to stay in it as much as move on.
Now, you're in the Talking Book Studios in Camden. Are you aware that 93% of all books will never be available to a blind or partially sighted audience?
No, I wasn't aware that it was quite that high a percentage. Am I surprised? No, not particularly. I mean, I suppose one would have hoped that in this age of allegedly, you know, easy transliteration between different media, that would no longer be the case. I mean, I don't know what it was like historically, whether that represents an attenuation of what's available to blind and partially sighted people, or whether it represents an expansion. I mean, you tell me.
That is a huge expansion. Over the last few years, it's maybe increased by 2 or 3% because, purely because of Kindles and electronic reading devices, which can read the book to you.
But that speech-to-text, particularly on Kindle, is pretty grim, isn't it? I mean, it's like a sort of robotic voice. They should sort that out. If I was those Kindle people, I would be working hard on modulating that speech-to-text, which can't be an impossible task. I mean, difficult, but not impossible.
RNIB have actually got their own synthetic speech generator, which your book will have been released in very briefly before the audiobook comes in. That would be interesting to listen to, actually, how a synthetic speech machine handles Umbrella.
Well, very interesting. I mean, since the theme of the book is the impact of technology and modernity, I mean, perhaps it's a particularly suitable way to hear the book.
Now, how important is it that your books are available in the audio format for everyone?
Well, I would like it to be available, obviously, in the audiobook for everybody. Yes, it is important to me, and that's why I've in the past read the text myself, in order to make it possible. I'm a pretty tireless public reader of my own work, and I'm always happy to come out and read it round your house if I can pin you down.
Thanks to Robert and to Will Self. You're listening to a special Easter edition of Read On, where we're going back over some of our favourite interviews.
Later, I'll be talking to a narrator live on stage at the Edinburgh Book Festival. But right now, here's Red talking to Giles Abbott, the UK's only registered blind Talking Books narrator.
Giles, welcome to the studio.
My pleasure.
So tell me, how did you start as a narrator at the Talking Book Studio?
It's something I'd always wanted to do, and I used Talking Books very extensively for a number of years after my eyesight went wrong, which was in 1998. And I was always trying to find a way, and I came for an interview, and I brought the first chapter of Bleak House by Charles Dickens, printed out with 20-point font, and I did the audition, and the man who auditioned me, he said, "The trouble is, we can't record you in the studio with all that paper flapping around, so we had to find another way." And sometime later I realized that I could get ebooks on a mobile phone, expand the font size hugely, and hold it to my nose practically. I think the first thing I recorded for RNIB was on a phone which no longer exists, because, I mean, they have a life of about 2 years, don't they? And I had to spend, every day recording with my eyes crossed, because I had to have it so close. It's got better since then. I can have the font that little bit bigger. In fact, now access to books, thanks to e-texts, etc., is almost as easy as it ever was, which is extraordinary.
And I believe the first book that you recorded was actually a Will Self book.
Yeah, I remember. Yes, it was. The Butt. Very interesting book.
And you've gone on to record Aesop's Fables, which I must say I've listened to with my children, which thoroughly enjoyed.
Oh, good.
And
that's Chesterton's translation of Aesop, because, of course, we don't... Well, I don't read him in the original ancient Greek. And different translations will make quite a difference to how you perceive the author. But actually, an interesting point, because you may remember that at the end of every story, it says, and the moral is... Yeah. I hated doing that. Because as a storyteller, I think if the audience haven't got their own idea about it, then they've not been listening. And who am I to crash in and tell them what they should think?
And
however, I did learn something that actually, and the moral is, it was never spoken in classical times. It was used as an index card system whereby orators who needed to find an Aesop story to illustrate a point in a speech could flip through looking for something on the moral of collaboration, thinking something on the moral of envy. And then they'd find the fable that they needed. So it was a filing system.
It was a search function.
Yeah, that exactly. Isn't that wonderful?
Oh, I learned something today, which is fantastic. So, and did the narration lead into a career of storytelling?
No, the other way around. I began telling stories... My eyesight went wrong in 1998. I began telling stories probably at the end of 1999. No, that was... I began telling stories in public at the end of 99. I began storytelling, although I didn't know that's what it was, pretty early on, to my wife. She used to love me to read her poetry when my eyes worked. My wife is dyslexic, and as is often the case with dyslexia, she is fabulously intelligent. A fact which was missed through much of her education, but not all of it. They caught up at last. She used to love me to read poetry and things to her, and of course I couldn't do that anymore. And who wouldn't miss doing something that their wife is happy when they do? So I began to remember, you know, there are certain stories you go to when you're sick, when you're a child, certain favourites that you read again and again. And actually, they become a bit of how you shape yourself. And so I began to think of the stories that I knew really, 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 really well, and I began to tell them to her, and some of them took weeks. Just, you know, we'd do a chapter, well, not a chapter or so, but what I could remember in little sections at night and then go to sleep.
And are you blessed with a good memory? When you learn your stories, do they stick, or do you need to practice them to recall them?
You need to practice anything if you want to be good at it. Mm. I am blessed with a very good memory for words.
And so when you're narrating now, I know a lot of the other narrators mark up their texts in various colours and with pencil marks. Do you use a similar system, or do you just commit to memory where you need to use which voice for the text?
I do mark up, yes. Which again is something you can do now that e-text is available. There are programs whereby you can change the colour of things. But yeah, because I mean, sometimes when I'm reading, I've only got a maximum 7 to 12 words on a page. It's hard to scan ahead. The engineers get used to this. We do lots of drop-ins and pickups.
Right.
But yeah, and it's about remembering the physical posture inside your face, inside your throat, for this or that character. I remember a few years ago, I recorded an audiobook for Audible, not for RNIB, in which the main character, it was a historical book, not a fictional one, but the main character was a very serious and rather earnest Victorian politician. And I got his voice by just pulling a certain face, a certain frown, and I found that it did something to the inside of my throat when I pulled a certain frown, and
if I do it now, then here he is. And I am looking at the state of Britain, by which I mean, of course, Greater Britain, Britain and her overseas dominions, and
you know, that kind of thing, and you just pull a face.
I see a great future for you as the Foreign Secretary, actually, Giles.
Oh, God. No, I'm a storyteller, not an outright... stop it.
And I should have laughed. I've completely forgotten my place.
Charles Abbott is momentarily discombobulated. Red Zell.
They might not even cut this bit out. So are you a great fan of audiobooks yourself, or do you still try and read them visually?
I used to be a huge fan of audiobooks. I still am. And when my eyesight first went, I was also physically very ill and very disabled for quite some time. So the RNIB Talking Book Studio was a lifeline. It literally was a line into the pit, because the loss of reading was one of the greater bereavements of my sight loss. And I loved it. Absolutely amazing. And because, as I mentioned, my wife is dyslexic, she finds it easier to process language that she hears than language that she sees, because she says the words pop like popcorn and skip about like a flea circus, which sounds awfully fun, but not very productive. And so we would listen to the books together, and it's like having a very, very intimate book club, which was glorious. Actually, some of the most fun I've ever had reading anything. And got some really wonderful books in the book library. Now, the disadvantage of talking books, and particularly when I was ill, is when you fall asleep, the pages keep turning. And you've got no idea. But, you know, you work, you cope, it's all right, you get there. But I used to find it very exciting, you know, finishing a book, turning the label over, sending it back, and I get another present. I mean, it did feel like a compensation present. It really felt wonderful.
I couldn't agree more. Hearing the snap of the letterbox and just knowing that your next book was waiting for you is something I really miss.
When I was living in the north of England, we lived in a beautiful Georgian millworker's cottage, attached, terraced. With no central heating, there was a solid fuel fire in the basement, and that heated the whole house. And the two sounds that made me really happy, one was the snap of the letterbox and a new audiobook, and then the thunder of the coal being poured into the coal hole. So then I knew I was going to be cosy and I was going to be able to travel in my mind. Yeah, that was wonderful. The next few weeks were taken care of. The match of narrator to text is key.
So I also noticed that one of the books you've recorded for the RNIB is How to Enjoy a Happy and Healthy Retirement. But I believe also that you have no plans for retirement yourself. You've got quite an exciting summer coming up.
I do. I have no plans for retirement because I don't imagine I will ever have what you might call a pension. So I intend to keep on going. I will be in the corner of a storytelling club one day, smelling slightly of deep heat lotion, and somebody will go, "Who's that? Oh, he's a storyteller." Or at least he was. He still thinks he is. I'll keep on going.
And a trip to Venice is in the offing, I believe, as well?
This is very exciting. My wife is an artist, a visual artist, and she is taking part in her second independent show at the Venice Biennale. It's a show organised by a London-based curator called Vanya Balog. It's called Empire 2. And it's taking place in a palazzo somewhere or other in Venice. And Vanya has asked a group of artists to contribute three-minute films. Now, these are not professional filmmakers, so he wanted it specifically to be like that because he thought they will come up with some interesting and unusual solutions because they've not done this before. And these films have now been edited together into a series of loops which will be displaying on different screens inside this palazzo. And during the private view, I'm going to be, because of the cinema theme, taking a classic of Italian cinema, which is Divorzio all'Italiana, which is Divorce Italian Style by Pietro Germi, and I'm going to reverse engineer it, to turn it back into a spoken word story.
Because, of course, all stories began as spoken word stories.
All storytelling begins with spoken word stories. I mean, this particular story was not originally a traditional story, though many films are. I mean, you know, King Arthur is back, Beauty and the Beast comes back every few years. Shrek is based on a traditional story, the first Shrek. It's based on The Marriage of Gawain. And the structure of Divorce Italian Style is, it's a classic quest structure, but because things keep going wrong for the protagonist, it's a comedy. And it is, it's very funny.
Thanks once again to Giles Abbott.
Now, Robert, next up, here's something that we've both experienced.
Yes, usually the shows are recorded in the comfort of a nice warm studio, but occasionally, as we did a few years back, the show is presented live on stage at the Edinburgh Book Festival. And if you want to hear myself and Red on stage live, just head to our Audio Boom page and search for Live at the Edinburgh Festival. A few years back, I was lucky enough to interview comedian and Talking Books narrator Juliet Burton.
And please welcome our next guest, Juliet Burton.
Hello.
Hello. Now, Juliet, you are a Talking Books narrator.
I am.
How did you get into Talking Books narration?
I got into Talking Books narration because I kind of started off doing quite a few voiceover jobs. That was one of my first things I did as an actor, kind of did lots of language tapes for people learning English as a foreign language. And then I randomly started working with a lot of varying disabled people with lots of various disabilities, and one of them is from Abnormally Funny People, who actually have a show on at the Stand in the Square, Simon Minty, and I perform with them now. But back then, they do a podcast, Abnormally Funny People, and I'm a comedian as well as many other things, and I perform comedy that kind of tries to break down barriers about mental health, because I've been sectioned under the Mental Health Act, and I've got lots of conditions that I've been diagnosed with. Anyway, I did a podcast with them, and it happened to be at the RNIB Camden studios. And I was kind of chatting to them about, how can I get into it? And I put my name forward and said, could I please audition? I would really love to audition to be involved. And I did audition. They liked me. And now I do a lot of books for them. And the reason I wanted to audition more than anything was because of my grandmother. My grandmother was one of the most incredible women. She died in 2012, and she at age 96, brilliant, and I hope I take after her in lots of ways. And she became partially sighted in her, I think, over the last 10 years of her life. And she was so intelligent throughout her and all of her life, loved reading. She was passionate about reading and learning more, as much as she possibly could, about the world. And of course, in these last 10 years, she relied heavily on audiobooks. And every Friday, my mum would go off and do her ritual of kind of doing the supermarket shopping and going to visit Granny and getting her hair done and taking Granny her new audiobooks. And Granny would read them so quickly that new ones had to be shipped in from across the country to try and satiate her passion for for reading. And I realised how she lived alone, and she was very independent, even though she was partially sighted and right up to the end of her life. And those books were a lifeline to her. She could continue learning and being entertained. And I just always imagined her kind of being alone at home listening to these voices, and it's a very intimate, very personal thing, and those voices almost become like a friend in some way, I think.
Is that in your head when you are narrating?
Absolutely. Yeah, I've narrated some fantastically fun books, some very interesting ones as well. Yeah. And I always imagine there's going to be the one person listening to my voice for 9 hours, probably not in one go, that might be long, and yeah, I think the longest book I think was nearly 20 hours that I've done recorded, and yeah, I just always imagine them kind of sitting there and hopefully being gripped by the story and caring about the characters, and it's just me and them really in our little world. So I love doing it. It's one of the best things, and it's so much fun, and I don't have to wear makeup for it. Great.
And what sort of books do you narrate now?
Robert and I are giggling because I've done quite a few different things. I've done some young adult fiction, I did a thriller. I've done sort of teenagery kind of things with like witches and sort of preteen chick lit in a way as well. But recently, I've been given quite a few erotica titles. I was given a Mills and Boone to do, so to speak, which was, I learnt a lot. And I've got my next one right here, which I'm doing in September, on the 14th and 15th of September. I'm recording Dark Obsession. I think, would you like me to read?
Yeah, and the voice you'll use for that book.
Are you ready? Right, hold on to your gussets. Lord James is spending an unusual amount of time in the stables while his idle son shows little interest in anything save his stepsister, Tanya. Meanwhile, Lady Marina is harbouring dark secrets of her own. Annabelle is drawn into a world of decadence where anything is allowed as long as a respectable appearance prevails. In an atmosphere of intensity and sexual secrecy, she becomes involved in a variety of interesting situations.
And that's about the only bit we could read out on radio.
Yeah. I actually use this book in my stand-up routine now because there's a page which...
you can't read.
I'm not going to read it, but there's some words on here that are just... They're just so wonderful that I get to... provide a service, I think, to people who are listening to these books and needing a bit of excitement in their lives. And yeah, it's very intimate.
And again, there's a serious side to that because you can get any kind of book you want out of RNIB's library. There's no censorship, no discrimination. If you want Postman Pat, you can get Postman Pat. If you want Dark Obsessions, you can have some Dark Obsessions.
I'm now imagining a combination of the two. That would be an interesting read.
Now you're running off to do your show. Look at Me has its final sold out night.
It's on in just under an hour, and we've sold out every single day, which has been wonderful. But today's the final day. It will be on tour around the country, but I will be doing other shows as well up at the Edinburgh.
What are you doing? Where can we see you?
Look at Me will be touring around the country next year. I'm also doing my free comedy show called Happy Hour. So that will be fun, and we'll just basically the whole point of Happy Hour is that we guarantee that you will leave feeling happy or you get your money back. I did say it was free. I'm also performing with Abnormally Funny People at the Stand in the Square. They perform at 9:40 p.m. every night. I'm performing with them on Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and then the last 2 days of the festival. And they are a group of disabled comedians who I've learnt a lot from, mostly about being funny. And they are wonderful, and I highly recommend them.
And when is Dark Obsessions going to be in the Talking Books library?
I don't know. It depends on how long it takes them to edit it and how much they blush during listening to it. But I will be recording it in September, so probably October. It'll be the perfect thing to read on a dark, lonely, stormy night.
Juliet Burton, thank you so much for joining me today on Read On.
Thank you so much. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Robert. I'll certainly be listening out for that book in the library.
I hear it's got a happy ending.
Well, after that, I feel I need a little bit of a lie down, so where better than in the psychoanalyst's chair?
It's very rare that I reread a book. From time to time, I might return to something I read years ago, but never within 5 years of first reading it. But there's an exception to every rule, and The Examined Life by Stephen Gross is a title I've found myself repeatedly drawn back to. And I'm not alone. It was on the Sunday Times bestseller list for 10 weeks. It was listed in the Daily Telegraph as one of the top 20 audiobooks and has been translated into more than 15 languages. So I'm genuinely thrilled to welcome its author, Stephen Gross, into the studio today.
I opened the windows in my consulting room a little and then went out to get my last patient of the morning. Lily stood up as soon as she heard me. "It's such a relief to be back here," she said. "I had a crazy time at home." Lily had just returned from a trip to New York to visit her parents with her 9-month-old daughter, Alice. The flight from London had been terrible. After navigating her way through the New York airport with Alice and all of their belongings, she found her mother standing outside on the sidewalk. "She hugged me the way she always does," Lily said. "She closes her eyes and pats my back, as if I have fleas." On my last night, after 3 glasses of wine, I tell my parents that when I get back to London I'm going to send them 1,000 photos of Alice. You have to understand, there are photos in every room of the house. There's a whole flotilla of photos on the grand piano, but nowhere is there a single photo of their first grandchild. And my mum says, "Oh my gosh, didn't you see it? It's my favourite." And she goes into the bedroom, rummages around in the dresser, and pulls out a picture of Alice. She smiles and says, "Oh, I love that picture." Then my dad says, "Oh, I love that picture." And then I say, "Oh, I love it too." But I'm thinking, what the fuck? Does she think I have X-ray eyes? I stifled a laugh. Lily was quiet for a moment.
One of the things that shines through your book, Stephen, is your love of literature. They read like beautifully crafted short stories, and yet they are about real people.
Yeah, I love short stories. I always feel that a short story is capturing a moment and trying to tell the truth of that moment. That's what I want to do in my book. The idea was that you could pick up and read the book and read any order. But when you read the book from front to back and read these stories in order, the first stories are more about the beginnings of life, and the last stories are about death and the end of life and various forms of leaving or endings. And I wanted readers to have a kind of sense of that arc or that trajectory from birth to death. It's also about my career, because I've been a practicing psychoanalyst for 30 years now, and I wanted to give a sense of my career from beginning to end as well. So there's that. But I also wanted to give some sense of a journey of discovery, so that almost like an analysis, a personal journey that you might take as a reader, that you would learn new things, and some of the later things will build on things that are in the beginning of the book. There were reasons, I mean, in terms of confidentiality, it's good to write briefly, because you can very much disguise my patients, and that's very important to me, that their privacy is respected, and I could change things, but tell the truth of the moment, and give a moment from their therapy. But I've also loved short stories. I loved chiefly Chekhov. Whenever I travel or whenever I go anywhere, it's often a volume of his stories. I'll always throw a collection of his stories. Kafka, Bruno Schultz. I love Isaac Babel, short stories. Frank O'Connor, Nabokov is another one that I like. Updike, short stories. Cheever. One of the things your listeners might enjoy that has been really special to me, it's a kind of education to me, The New Yorker magazine does a fiction podcast with Deborah Treisman, and she gets a short story writer to read one of their favorite short stories from the magazine and then talk to her about their choice. To me, it was an education as a writer, those short stories, about 100 of them now. They're the most fabulous listening experience. The reading is beautiful. Deborah Treisman is the best fiction editors, talking with a fiction writer about a first-rate fiction story. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing to listen to.
There's also an element of parable about the stories that you tell. We all experience the same emotions and same tragedies and have to deal with them.
I think one of the things people liked about the book was I took them into the world of what analysts, psychotherapists, counselors think about when they're working with patients. They make mistakes, we make mistakes, we get things wrong. At one point, I point out how, just like a good teacher might envy a brilliant student or a good coach, a successful athlete, in a way that an analyst will envy a successful patient. Maybe I've helped somebody cure something in their life that I haven't sorted out in my own. We're human, and it's very important to see that. And if only by bringing those aspects in, I think will a reader believe you and accept the truth of what you're saying. You have to be honest, very honest on the page. And I tried to do that. But you're right. And I tried to choose the stories, the 30-some stories in the book. I tried to think, what were the most important things, issues that my friends would want to know about, that my wife would want to know about? People ask me, what are the really essential issues? And then I tried to address those from my clinical notebooks, from the things, my experiences, and my work. So I tried to talk about the things that I thought were most important.
Yes, and of course the full title is The Examined Life, How We Lose and Find Ourselves. And I suppose in some ways what you're trying to do is stop us losing ourselves as a reader, or help us rediscover ourselves through your observations over 25 years.
There are many ways we get separated from ourselves, and we have that feeling of being trapped, that life should be different than it is, or how did we get here, or separated from the things we loved and loved doing. And so I wanted to give a kind of picture of how that those things can happen to us. One of the key themes of the book is the relationship between change and loss. And so many of the stories have to do, people come to me because they want to change, and they can't. In the beginning of the preface, I quote a patient of mine who once said, I want to change, but not if it means changing.
Yes.
And we've all felt that, you know, I want to change, but oh my gosh, do I have to really start exercising? And do I really have to go out and do this and do this and this and this, the things which I know to be true? And a lot of the difficulties that I try to point out is that all change involves loss. If you're going to do a new thing, you have to give up an old way of doing things. And that's very painful for us. Life is, in a sense, a series of necessary losses. From birth, we give up the womb to enter into the world. We give up the breast to have food. We give up our home to start going to nursery school and the comfort of our mother. And leaving home and marriage, too, is giving up our original family to make a new family. You know, we think they should all be happy, but they do involve letting go of things which we've cherished. And some people find that so difficult to do that they can't do that. So I want to talk about that in the book and try and help people see, you know, that's why sometimes, for example, there's stories in the book about people who have a success and have a breakdown. That's not an uncommon thing, or achieve something and then become incredibly unhappy with the change, even though they've worked for years to get to a certain place. They can become all of a sudden filled with depression. So I want to understand some of those things and that we see around us, but we can't quite figure out. And I tell stories to try and explain that to readers.
I suppose living in an oral tradition as we do, maybe that's why The Examined Life has translated so well to audiobook, because especially with Peter Marinka's wonderful reading.
Yeah, he was fantastic.
And I believe you had a hand in selecting him to read the book.
We talked about different people, and that experience of listening to different voices and discussing it and, you know, asking him to do it. And we met in a pub before coming over, and we chatted about ourselves. And Peter's father was a doctor in Canada, where he was raised. And we spoke for a while, and he said, oh, I know what, I'll do my father's doctor voice. And his voice dropped about an octave, and we had this wonderful, slightly gravelly tone to it, which, you know, was fantastic.
Throughout the visit, neither of Lily's parents showed much interest in her life. They left their two televisions blaring and ate their meals crammed around the kitchen counter. Her father often ate with his laptop propped open next to his plate.
It was an amazing experience listening to it on audiobook, because my stories began in conversation. They began through listening and through speaking, and I transferred that onto the page. And the audiobook experience of having them transferred back off the page into a voice was amazing. It was electrifying. And Peter also did the Book of the Week on the radio, BBC. And the first time I heard it, I was just being in my kitchen having a cup of coffee with my wife, and we sat down to listen. And it was electrifying in a way totally I just not expected. It was a wonderful thing, a wonderful experience.
I know you're a very keen listener of listener to audiobooks anyway. So
I've been listening recently to Juliet Stevenson reading the Henry James A Portrait of a Lady, which is fantastic. And there's some, you know, that are wonderful. The Elena Ferrante novels, which are so popular right now, I think are beautiful on audiobook. But my favorite book recently that I've read, I've been really moved by the writing of an American writer. Readers and, you know, listeners may not know him. His name is Kent Harouf, and he's from Colorado. He died last year, and he wrote a wonderful trilogy called the Plainsong Trilogy, and that's beautifully read on audiobooks. But the last one is the book I'm enjoying so much right now, and it's a book that I press into people's hands. It's called Our Souls at Night. And it's the story of a 70-year-old man and a 70-year-old woman. And she's a widow. He's a widower. They live in this fictional town he's created through all of his books over his life called Holt, Colorado. And it begins on the first page. This widow visits her neighbor down the road a bit and says, I was wondering if you'd like to sleep with me. And she's saying, not how you might think, but I get a feeling you're lonely at night, and I'm lonely at night, and I was wondering if you'd just like to come over to my house. And anyway, he takes her up and on her offer, and they basically they lie on the bed and hold hands and talk. Now, it's beautiful on the page. It's beautifully written. But the audio book of it is fabulous because it's mostly the conversation of these two people about their life together, you know, their lives with their wives, their children, the raising. And slowly through this conversation, through talking, they fall in love and the relationship deepens. And then it's about the reaction of the world around them. And I don't want to give away what happens and how what goes on for the rest of the book. I just read that it's about to be made into a film. So before whatever they're going to do with it, they do to it. It's a beautiful piece of writing and a beautiful audiobook, I think.
Well, thank you. That sounds like a fantastic recommendation. Yeah. And can we expect another book in the near future?
I'm working on a book where the first book was about change and loss. What I'm writing now is about the obstacles to falling and remaining in love, the difficulties of that, and why it's so hard, and what happens and when we make bonds with other people and then when we break those bonds of love as well. So that's what I'm working on, Red.
Stephen Gross, thank you very much for coming into the studio. Thanks. And sharing your love of reading with our listeners. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not subscribe to our podcast? We're available from all the major platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or just search for RNIB Talking Books in your favourite podcast app. If you need any help, have any questions about the show, or just want to keep up to date with us, why not look for us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sail, that's REDSZELL, and producer Robert is at talking_books. So, farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.